So here it is, already Sunday. Time went very quickly. I don't know about you, but I guess it depends how much pleasant feeling tone you had, I guess. You have lots of pain, time goes very slowly. But when you're having fun, time goes fast when you're having fun, isn't there something? So hopefully during this time anyway, you've had occasion to hear something about the instructions and a bit about the teachings, and maybe opportunity to have some experiences as well. And I mentioned this morning, I guess it was, or yesterday, I mean, the experience is the most important part. And maybe at this time, you know, it's a bit hard to kind of interpret or integrate your experiences. You know, we have, I talk about the meditation instructions, and then there's a meditation process, and then there's meditation itself. And these three, kind of just as a way of talking, they're kind of three distinct areas. First of all, there's basic instructions, and you know, that level, it's still, there's still much reference to usually a person doing something and focusing on the breathing, developing some degree of concentration, developing the exercise in awareness, mindfulness to the body, feeling tone, states of mind, and the phenomena. But the these exercises are sort of designed to facilitate what I call the meditation process. That is, once some of these qualities are energized to some degree, particularly calmness facilitated by concentration, clarity of mind facilitated by increased awareness, and then things begin to happen, as it were. As a meditative process goes on. And even you don't so-called succeed at the exercises, you know, even over this weekend, if you weren't able to observe your breathing for any sustained length of time, it's not so important. When we look at it from the point of view of the meditative process, because the exercises really are just one aspect to the bigger picture, you know, whether you succeed or fail isn't so important, but what you learn in the process. And many times, maybe it's more valuable to learn, if you can, when you fail. You know, like I mentioned already about this, the fact, for example, you try and watch your breath, and you notice the mind is very busy, very distracted. Well, it's a very valuable lesson to learn. As far as, if you're just looking at the meditation exercises, well, I can't do it. But in meditative process, it's working. There is an insight into the nature of your mind. You know, the exercises and meditation exercises still are, I'll say, in the realm of relative truth. There's somebody trying to do something to get a certain result, and I succeed or I fail. But in the process, in the meditative process, everything's part of the picture. Yeah, so we just use those exercises to investigate what's going on around it within that context of trying to absorb, to focus attention on the breathing, for example, and what happens. Yeah. Is the mind able to settle down? Maybe the mind can't settle down. Why is that? These experiences are going on anyway, but most of us don't have a chance to notice them. Your mind is restless anyway, and you just keep going with the restlessness and don't even stop and notice, hey, I stop, my mind is still going. But you come here and you stop. You try and watch the breath, your mind's still going. Aha, interesting. Now you know that, and now, you know, I can say the next step once we see that, now what to do about it? Is it very pleasant, you know, to have a wandering, distracted, confused mind? Is it very pleasant? Nobody put their hand up, so I can't presume. Well, sometimes, maybe it is, if you're... There's a saying, ignorance is bliss, you know. In different ways to distract yourself from different levels of distraction. I think it was T.S. Eliot, distracted from distraction by distraction. Most people's state of mind. But once we get some understanding of what's going on and even just being able to experience that, how does it feel? When I notice my distracted mind, my experience was it wasn't very pleasant. Yeah. And I did have an understanding that, you know, being in the present moment was being alive. And I noticed I was hardly ever in the present moment. I was in the past, going romanticizing the past, what happened in the old days, and I was planning the future. I was almost never here, you know, being alive in this moment. So then I tried to bring my mind to the present moment, and boy, I'm still working on it. Lifetime enterprise. But it is better. The mind is here more often. Maybe we could even say maybe sometimes it's even here more often than it's there. At least I know sometimes that even though the mind, you know, your mind does sometimes, there are memories coming up. But now I can recognize the memories arising in the mind right now. I don't chase after the past. I can think about the future, plan the future, but I'm planning it right now. Not in the future, but right now. It's just a thought in the mind, okay. Today's Sunday, right? It's helpful in the monastery, you forget sometimes. I don't need to be at work Monday morning at 9 o'clock, you see. In fact, Monday's a day off. We work on the weekends. So when I used to work in the restaurant, we used to work on the weekends and have the busiest time. But you know, one can, if one has some understanding of how the mind really works, you know, then you can recognize, okay, I can think about the future, you know, the so-called future, but I know it's only, you know, it's only an idea. And then recognizing that, well, if the future doesn't work out, no disappointment, because it's not certain. Before that, you know, particularly one of the biggest shocks was going to a country like India, where, you know, I was thinking my usual Western way, oh yes, I have to go here and do this and do that. I have to go to travel down to this place. Yeah, so I go to the train, it didn't take long before you go to the ticket office the first time. Takes you 2 days to get a ticket. To 5 different offices, you know. So my plan to get it to go somewhere had to be changed. So my planning got frustrated continually. So I realized don't rely upon it. And then that was the experience there, but then going to Thailand, especially one of Ajahn Chah's kind of principal teaching was always to remind us things are uncertain. Very simple in Thai, mai nay, uncertain. So we'd be thinking about, oh yes, I have to go down to Bangkok and get my visa and I have to need it. Mai nay. Thank you. Because really things are very uncertain. we hope and we wish that they'd be certain. And tomorrow at 9 o'clock, I'll be at the office or whatever you're going to be tomorrow at 9 o'clock, you know, and bright and early and bright and alive and refreshed with concentration and mindfulness. But maybe you get lost on the way home. You know. Best you don't take your mindfulness with you. You leave it with your cushion here. And it really is uncertain. I mean, that's reality. I mean, that's what And then, you know, we, this is what the Buddha reminds us, but through the exercises, through the meditative process, you can begin to see it yourself. You know, you observe, for example, the nature of this, the sensations in the body, you know, especially the exercise of moving attention through the different parts of the body. You know, what do you notice about them? What's the common feature about these sensations? I gave it away, these sensations. Are they the same sensations every time? Is it the same body every time? Huh? Not to mention your mind. Think the same thoughts every time? Huh? Thank goodness. Variety is the spice of life, right? And I mentioned already about the, you know, the Buddha's, one of the most significant teachings of the Buddha, and which was also instrumental in his awakening, was the understanding, the realization of causality. It's more technically conditional causality. And what this, I mean, this was a real significant for himself, allowed the Buddha to be awakened. It's also a very significant feature for the history of humanity as well, because the Buddhists introduced us to process-orientated consciousness. Pretty big, long word, isn't it? Three words, actually. The Buddha's allowing us to understand about the whole nature of reality is process, continually changing. Everything's in process, or impermanent, if you want to use the Pali term. Everything's changing all the time. And really, the humanity hasn't even caught up to the Buddha yet in 2,500 years. You know, just maybe more recently, with people getting more familiar with quantum physics, but not a quantum physics. The physicists are realizing, hey, at first they were looking for things, you see, the ultimate bedrock of reality, you know, atoms and these things, you know. You want to find the ultimate nature of reality, the ultimate substance. They looked and they looked, no substance. It's just process. Yeah, that was the Buddha's experience too. In his time, the religion at that time, Brahmanism, believed in this, there's the ultimate nature of a human being is an Atman, is a soul, is a permanent abiding soul that transmigrates into endless lifetimes. So of course the Buddha received that teaching as a young person. But when he went off on a spiritual quest, he began to look for this so-called ultimate essence of the human being, the Atman. So he looked and he looked and he looked and couldn't find it. Then he had this, you know, special insight into contemplating the nature of reality. And he began to see the processes there. What causes death? Well, being born causes death. What causes birth? Coming into existence. He went through a whole series of different causes. Just as maybe you might do with this inquiry, what's the cause of this thought? What's the causes of this thought? And eventually the Buddha comes to the realization, it's all just processes. There is no essence to it. There is no substance. There is no object behind it. It's just process. So, I mean, it's understandable, at least intellectually. Practically, we all are looking for an object, you know. It's the nature of ego, of self. It wants to have something, wants to have a subject. Can say, this is me, you know, some permanent entity. But with these exercises, if you keep observing, you know, for example, you observe the nature, if we could only know this body here, first of all, we come from the point of view, this is body, right? This is a thing, a body. And we only know this body through being aware of sensation, so we directly know the body, other than the concept in your brain. You know, a little picture in your brain, body, this is my body. But we can only know the body directly by sensation. So you bring awareness to sensations in the body, and what do you see? Is there an essence behind it? Just sensations, sensating. The body, the so-called body is only sensating. It's only a process of physical processes going on to a lifetime. And when these physical processes get a bit too weary, they break up. In the Buddhist scriptures, when they talk about death, one of the most frequent references to death is the breakup of the body. It doesn't say anybody died. Say the body broke up. You know? It's like the party broke up, you see? Of course, there's a little bit of a deeper understanding behind it, because in a Buddhist view of, an Indian view of things, all physicality, all materiality, is made of four elemental aspects: earth, fire, water, air. You see? So what we in the West would say, maybe it's atoms and molecules in this body. You know, just what happens to the atoms? You know, what happens to the atoms when this life force ends? Your atoms break up. You know, carbon goes to carbon, oxygen to oxygen, to, you know, whatever, there, nitrogen to nitrogen, uranium to uranium, strontium 90. You know, we got a lot more basic elements in our body than we did in the Buddhist times. But those atoms break up, you know, and we don't know. I mean, we don't know how many atoms of other people are just floating around here right now, you see, okay? in this planet. All the people who have been here in a long history of humanity have died. Their atoms have broken up. They're still floating around, huh? Atoms don't disappear, right? Except in an atom bomb, maybe. So how many oxygen molecules are you breathing from somebody else who died already 1,000 years ago? In a Buddhist sense, it's just four of them: earth, fire, water, air. So the body breaks up, the elements go back to the elements again. Consciousness is also part of, you can say, the life force. Consciousness leaves the body. Yeah, so when you begin to, you know, you can know this intellectually with your left brain, but through the exercise, you can observe sensations, 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 and what else is there? Just sensations, just processes here. And the more that you begin to understand this, and the deeper your realization, you have a different relationship to this body then. You don't think of this body as a thing that I can just kind of boss around. You know, you have to listen to it and learn to live in harmony with those physical processes. If we don't, we get sick. That's what sickness is. You aren't in harmony with your physical processes. That's what they used to say in India too with sickness. Somebody got sick, and they just say, "Oh, their air element is out of balance." You see, the Ayurvedic system, your air system, your air element is out of balance. So they take certain things to balance the air element, or the water element, or earth element, or something, and get the four elements back in harmony again, and you're healthy. But if you don't listen to the body, we put this concept into our brain, the body should be like this, and don't listen to it, we're out of harmony. Then you suffer. Suffering is disharmony. And of course, the same with the mind. Yeah, we think mind. I mean, probably most of you have, you know, a little bit better education these days, so you don't think that mind is a thing. Can you show me your mind? Come on, put it on the table right now. Put your mind right here so I can see it. You can put your brain there, but you but don't, please. we just had the meal, you know. But we have the concept. We only have a concept of mind as being something, and then I can control my mind. Yeah? Probably this weekend you learned how little control you have over your mind. Huh? You know, I say to the mind, "Watch the breath." And the mind says, "The heck with you. This is a holiday. This is Saturday morning. This is a holiday. You watch the breath. I'm having a holiday." So if you identify with that concept in your mind, I got to watch my breath. If that's your sense of self, then if it with that, you got a problem. Because your mind doesn't agree with it. But then you begin to observe this process, and then you notice maybe the first insight is just how little control we have over our mind. I know when I first had that insight, it was a bit of a shock. You know, what? I don't. My mind's out of control. You know that if you take a bit longer, that means you're crazy. See? And here I was at university, and they told me I was intelligent. When I observed my mind, I realized I'm out of control. Actually, to me, I'm crazy. But as long as the teachers say you're intelligent, okay, thank you. After a while, I didn't believe them, though. But then if we understand it's all process. You know, if you can take a little bit of a guidance from the Buddha's teaching, it's all process. What we call mind is the continuum of mental processes. And some of those mental processes are, you can say, beneficial, some not so beneficial. As I mentioned, formally speaking, some are the so-called hindrances, some are the factors of awakening. So you begin to observe now what some of these factors of mind are. You can begin to, in a way, you can begin to pick and choose. What do you want to energize now? The hindrances or the factors of awakening? Where do you put your attention? Where do you put your energy into? But you have to understand the processes first, you see. Some of these factors, like concentration, you know, which facilitates calmness of mind. You know, I mentioned already a few supportive qualities. The continuity, having one object to keep focusing on, can facilitate concentration. If you enjoy what you're doing, joy is a factor of awakening. It also supports concentration. There's a few qualities we begin to notice. What's the cause of concentration? What's the cause of that particular state of mind? What allows it to fade away? What destroys it? You know, confusion, doubt, worry. Destroys it. Okay. Better to go back to the breath again. Better than get lost in your confusion and fear. Back to the breath. That'll increase the concentration. Not destroy it. And you start understanding some of these processes, then you can begin to work with them now. And you can begin to develop the skillful ones, and you begin to recognize how beneficial they are. I mean, just as far as, you know, emotion goes, you know, they're very uplifting, peaceful, blissful even. And then mentally speaking, too. You have more clarity of mind, you have more understanding, more wisdom. You begin to see the way things really are. So you can live in harmony with reality rather than always in conflict with it. This is how the body really is. This is how the mind really is now. You can live more in harmony with it. So we continue with the exercises. They're helpful. But I think probably most of you are leaving from this particular environment here. So if you appreciate the benefits you can get from developing the meditation exercises, I would say it could be helpful if you could be able to continue with them the best you can. This requires some flexibility, as I mentioned this morning, about walking meditation. You know, rather than trying to find a place, you know, in your office or in your home maybe, where you can have a walking meditation path. Maybe you have to kind of create one in your own environment. There's one of our supporters in England, and he was a very, very, very dedicated meditator. So, you know, when he was a lawyer working in an office, a law office in Manchester, and we went to work, and at lunchtime everybody else went out to the cafeteria to eat or cafe or something or other. Well, he didn't eat a big meal, see? So he'd want to use that time for meditation. So the only place he could meditate was in the cupboard, in the closet. So he even had his meditation cushion there, see, stored in the closet, you see. So, you know, he's one of these closet Buddhists. Okay, it's a bad one. but he really was literally. He came to work in his suit, not his robe, you know, not a monk's robe, and then he'd open the closet at lunchtime and get out his meditation cushion and sit there in the closet. But one day, one of the cleaning people found his cushion and wondered, is he having a nap in there, or what's he doing? They couldn't imagine he's meditating. He must be sleeping. But maybe you can be a bit more creative, find ways to continue with the practice. And, you know, there's the formal exercises, you know, sitting and walking, but the whole purpose of them is to facilitate concentration and calm and mindfulness and awareness. So if you look around in your life, what will facilitate those? And basically, I mean, a simple rule of thumb is if you have some repetitive task you have to do, something you do repetitively, you know, that's very supportive of concentration, you know, just washing one plate after the other, you know, very simple. It's like watching the breath come in and go out and come in and go out. You're walking somewhere, repetitive step, 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 step. You can use that as an exercise in concentration. If you're doing something which is a bit more, you need a bit more activity, a bit more variety, that can be supportive of mindfulness and awareness. You have to be very alert to know what you're doing and not spill your spill your food or cut your finger when you're cooking or something. It takes more mindfulness and awareness if you can appreciate what that quality is and how to use it and how to develop it then. And okay, it's only a little bit here, a little bit there, but if it all adds up through the course of a day. When I was living in Switzerland, the people there mostly have a very, very busy life, work long hours. They come to the monastery for a weekend retreat, and then when they want to go home, they say, how to continue my meditation? And if it's if they've done a bit of a longer retreat, a week or so at least, and they're very inspired, they say, I'm going to get up at 5 o'clock in the morning and meditate before work. They start for work at 6, you see. This is Switzerland, you see. I don't know what time you get up for work. It's Australia? 8 o'clock? Well, you get up and do surfing first, right? And then get up at 6 for surfing, but only go to work at 9. But of course, you know, their life is already very busy. They have put a lot of energy into work. So the first day they get up at 5 o'clock, next day 5:30, the next day 6, and then back to being normal again. And say, when's the next retreat? So my advice to them was, rather than try and change your life around to suit your meditation, look in your life what will support meditation. You know, and everybody has these moments when you're waiting for the bus, waiting for a telephone call, waiting in the queue for the checkout counter or the bank or something or other. What do you do when you sit when you're waiting? Do you watch your breath? Huh? You probably are getting nervous and, come on, let's get going, let's get out of here, let's I can go meditate. But if you use those moments, you know, to focus on your breath. Yeah. Or you got the few moments to walk from the bus to your office or something. It only takes you 5 minutes, 10 minutes. But if you use that time for walking meditation, you know, how many times a day, twice a day, or up the stairs and down the stairs. In a monastery in Switzerland, it was a 4-story former hotel, you see. And so it was lots of walking up and down the stairs. I mean, there I learned that being unmindful was painful. I came down, I forgot that up in my room in the third floor. I got to go up again. I get up there, I forgot that on the ground floor. I got to go down and get... So I made an exercise of whenever I went to the stairs, this was walking meditation. Climbing the stairs meditation. Up to the stair, up the... When I got to the the third floor where the monks lived. Aha, now I remember what I forgot. And then when I'm going down the stairs, I stop and, what did I forget? Aha, okay, back to my room. And instead of going down the stairs and up again, I could, you know. So it became a point of an exercise in stopping, collecting oneself, and then mindfully walk down the stairs. And going up again, collect oneself, what have I forgotten? Walk up again. And it was many times a day, so there was maybe half an hour of walking meditation just in the house every day, half an hour. What if you want to go outside and it's snowing? No, thank you. Do walking meditation in the snow? No. Well, we did have to be adaptable, so we did go cross-country skiing. Meditation. That's what you do in Switzerland, you know. you don't walk around the meadows like in England. You have to use the skis. It's at 1,200 meters in the Swiss Alps. So 5 months of snow. So the way to get around is on skis. Yeah. So we had to adapt to the time and place. And it's very good physical exercise, cross-country skiing. One of the best exercises you can do, actually, because you have to use your arms and your legs. So if you look around in your life, you know, what will support calmness, calm collectedness, concentration? What will support more clarity, mindfulness, awareness? If you look around in your life, you find opportunities then. You know, maybe it's not sitting there quietly for half an hour watching your breath, but it will support collectedness and calm or clarity of mind. And then if you look around, you know, if you count the time you meditate, like some people, especially like in Switzerland, they have lots of clocks, you see, so everybody goes by the clock, you know. You haven't meditated unless you sat there for an hour, you see. But if you do that, well, you know, you look around and you get 5 minutes here, 5 minutes there, 5 minutes somewhere else. Probably at the end of the day, you got an hour all come together. And the most important part, I would say, is not the kind of quantity so much as the quality. Because if you have these moments through the day where you have to collect yourself, then you don't get so scattered. Yeah. Some people, they have a practice of meditation in the morning, they go through their life, and then meditation in the evening again. Yeah, but that 8 hours in the day, they aren't meditating. they're stirring their mind up with busyness and activity and not being very clear or very collected. So they come back in the evening to meditate, and they've got to process 8 hours of unmindfulness. Whereas, you know, if you just happen to have, you know, some practice every couple of hours, even a few minutes, collect yourself. Bring your awareness and your concentration at the present moment. And your mind doesn't go so far and doesn't get so scattered. And you have some, not the same intensity, but you have some continuity then. Some level of continuity of mindfulness and collectedness through your life. If you do have time in the evening to do a formal exercise, formal meditation exercise, you'll notice calmness, there's already a basis of calm there already, which you've maintained throughout the day. Then you can just increase it. This is what Ajahn Chah would recommend to us as a monk in a monastery. He says, use everything as an opportunity for collectedness and awareness, everything. Sweeping leaves, eating the meal. I mean, we even have in the monastic rules, there are very even detailed rules about how to mindfully eat your food, how to mindfully fold our robes, how to mindfully go to the toilet, would you believe? There's certain special guidelines mentioned, you know, and some of them, if you don't follow them, it becomes an offense. Yeah, not to have your robe sloppily put on or something or other. It's actually a minor offense. So we have those as a guideline, but, you know, to help more mindfulness too. So, you know, the opportunity is there, and if you have that ability to adapt the practice, the formal exercises into what I call the informal meditation, you'll find that it does support. You do have time for the formal exercises then. In the meantime, the meditation process is happening. You know, whatever we're doing, if you do have more mindfulness and collectedness and calm, then the meditation process works by itself. Then you may notice sometimes that meditation happens. As I mentioned, the meditation exercises is very much still within the realm of relative reality. Me sitting, watching my breath, developing concentration. The process, meditation process, is a little bit more selfless, because we're observing what's really going on, not in my body, but in this body, in this mind. Observing what's really going on, not how I want it to be, but how it really is. And sometimes meditation happens. You notice that there is, without any effort, there is clarity, calm, mindfulness, insight, wisdom, tranquility, equanimity. It's right there. What did I do right today? It's the fruit of applying the exercises. You know, you begin to change some of these restless habits of mind into more collected habits of mind, if you like. And then you begin to recognize sometimes your mind's different. Yeah. There is peace there. You don't have to make the peace by watching your breath and trying to calm your mind down. It's right there. Aha. Uh-huh. That's what I say. That's when meditation happens. When there's nobody doing it. It happens automatically. Ajahn Chah once gave the analogy. It's like you said, when you're developing mindfulness, it's like turning on a tap. See, at first you just turn the tap a little bit and your mindfulness is just drip, drip, drip. Huh? Is that today? Or that was yesterday? Today you turn on a bit more and then it's drip, drip, drip. Yeah? And you keep going with it, and before you know it, it's a steady flow of mindfulness then. Yeah. And a steady flow of mindfulness, that's called an arahant. Somebody who's fully enlightened, fully awakened then. Continuous mindfulness. See? But maybe we're just the drip or the drop. But the more you keep it up, you begin to see, it begins to become part of our way of life, just normally. More clarity, more collectedness, more calm. You know, it is in a way, it is our nature, but we've stirred it up with all of our stories about ourselves. Yeah? So we've stirred up our natural calm mind. You know, if you look at what the disturbances of your mind are, what is it? Mostly the story of me. If you put down the story of me, very peaceful. Huh? No problems. No worries, mate. Of course, it's a little bit easier said than done. So, so it's helpful to have some continuity. And it's always, you know, as part of the continuity, it's also helpful if you have either a supportive environment or supportive friends. You know, it was easy, you know, in Switzerland, there were meditation groups in all the different main cities. So I could recommend them go to those meditation groups. At least they meet once a week to get some group support. You have your own personal meditation practice. You can have a opportunity to meet with other people, like-minded people, to continue, give you some encouragement. And discuss your experiences, maybe. And then maybe once in a while, come to a meditation retreat or a monastery. Or not only does it give you more support in your practice, but you have more opportunity to practice in different environments. Some people prefer to practice on their own. You know, when I first learned meditation in Sri Lanka, Sri Lanka was, we had a had to be in a room, but there was other people around. But in Thailand, my first 3 years were on my own, just sitting in my own little hut, peaceful hut. It was peaceful for a while until my mind started acting up. But then going to stay with Ajahn Chah, he emphasized a lot of group practice. And it was very, first of all, I had a lot of aversion towards it, even. There's definitely a lot of unpleasant feeling tone, especially getting up at 4 o'clock in the morning, 3 o'clock in the morning, actually. Meditation four. But in Thailand, it's the coolest part of the day, and the mosquitoes are still asleep. So, but then being with other people in a room, you know, I wasn't desensitized to them. I was used to being on my own. So when being in a group, somebody was always coughing or shuffling or something, and they disturbed my samadhi. See? It kept me from getting enlightened because of their noise. It wasn't me, it was their fault. But gradually one gets used to it, and then one can get the support of the group. You know, many, many mornings I wasn't very inspired myself to get up at 3 o'clock and sit there at 4 o'clock. But everybody else was doing it, and so, well, I'll go along too. I'll support the group. Sometimes it was more like, if they can do it, I can do it. I'm not going to be a wimp. But other times it was, you know, supporting the group effort, you see. So sometimes you can get some support in the group, you know. Other times you don't have a group, so you got to practice on your own. So it helps to be flexible and adaptable. But, you know, there are opportunities. This place is always here. You know, maybe you know you have some local meditation group near you where you can join sometimes. And maybe you can have your friends, you know, invite a few friends around sometime to just sit together. You know, quite a few of the groups in Switzerland, for example, it was just a few friends got together to support each other. And you make an appointment, you know, on a Wednesday night at 7 o'clock. Rather than watch television, we're going to go together, sit together and meditate together. So then somebody says, let's go out to a party at 7 o'clock Wednesday. Sorry, I already have a booking. I'm already pre-booked to meditate that night. And they say, meditation? Oh, I hear this is really trendy. Can I come too? Forget the party, let's go meditate. Then you get four people, and then you get five, and then you become a meditation teacher. be careful. So I mean, if we appreciate the benefits of the practice, hopefully we can find the occasion, the opportunity to continue with the exercises, and in a variety of different ways, you know, and then you begin to see the results for yourself. You know, at a certain point, maybe you notice meditation happening. You realize, aha, it is working. There is a cause and effect relationship there. You know, Ajahn Chah said, you know, one of his quotes was something like, you know, you practice a little bit, you get a little bit of result. You practice a lot, you get a lot of results, basically. It's not a deterministic cause and effect. It's a conditional causality. You know, you can sit and sit and sit, but you don't have the right attitude, you just get sore knees, that's all. Somebody asked Ajahn Chah about, you know, why don't they do so much sitting meditation in the monastery? And what Papong, the monks, as he said, he advises monks to try and be collected and aware and doing everything, sweeping the leaves and doing all kinds of activities. So there's a lot of emphasis upon just sitting all the time. So this person asked him, why is there so much sitting in the monastery? He said, well, I've seen chickens sit in their nests for hours and days and not get any wiser. It's not about sitting. It's about what your state of mind is, you see. Yeah. And of course, it's a bit harder to see what somebody's state of mind is when they're sweeping leaves or they're cleaning the toilets. Hard to notice their state of mind. Yeah. But when you see somebody sitting, well, obviously they must be enlightened, you know. Because I got the posture anyway. At least it looks like you're enlightened, but probably you're asleep. But anyway, you know, but if you're cleaning the toilets, that's not very enlightened activity, cleaning toilets, I mean. But depends upon your state of mind. That's the most important part, though. So it's not about so much about the formalities, the formal sitting and walking does have a place, but don't become too obsessed with it. It's really important part is the quality of the mind. So you have to know this for yourself. You see this for yourself. You know this for yourself. Is your mind really calm or not? Now, what facilitates calm and clarity? And each one of us, there's this general guidelines we can get from the Buddha's teachings, but you know, in the refined levels, you have to know for yourself, because each one of us is very different. We all have the basics of greed, aversion, delusion, but we all have our particular brand of greed and aversion and delusion. So certain parts of the practice we have to maybe personalize much more to our own individual temperament. So you have to know this for yourself. But with increased awareness of bodily awareness and states of mind, you begin to know this particular mind here, what it needs, what how to work with it in a skillful way to increase collectedness and calm then. So hopefully you get some overview of the general principles of practice, and hopefully maybe enough positive experience that you can continue on your own and see the results for yourself. And then it's all up to you now. So I wish you all the best in your practice.
Is there some announcements?
Yes.
That's a friend I'd like to make, isn't it?
Yes, a few requests for everybody. I wish the garbage bins, that garbage bag on the table. It would be very nice if they could take some garbage with you. There are only 5 bags, so don't fight too hard about it. Because we don't have a rubbish service pickup here. That's question 1. Question 2 is, please take care that you clean your kuti. And cleaning means also making it clean. So sweeping, giving a good mop, because we don't have room service cleaning in the monastery. So if it could sleep, you know, if you see cobwebs, please take them away, things like that. And please take all your belongings with you and have a good look around, also around the kitchen area, because there are quite a few items everywhere that you take everything with you. And also the kitchen crew, could they have a look in the kitchen and everything that you have taken to the monastery is taken back again, because we don't have so much room in the kitchen to store all the things which I left behind. And I wanted to thank everybody who had a task. You all did a very good job. Thank you for your help. And I hope you had a good routine. Thank you.
That is the test, you see.
Yes.
That you very mindfully